Hello, 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 geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers, and welcome to another episode of Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Before we get into the episode proper, I just wanted to make the announcement that we are now 2 weeks away from the Animus Takeover, where my part-time co-host, Jerry Hartman, is going to be taking over the tombs for an entire episode and interviewing me and AK Herrera. We're both kind of terrified of what he's going to come up with to ask us because he's been working on the questions ever since we decided we were going to do this. And he's guaranteed me that there are going to be some pretty fucked up questions. So yeah, me and AK are both kind of terrified about what's going to be popping up when he questions us. But whatever, we'll be good sports about it, and we'll go along with whatever he asks. So we will be recording that on May 21st, and I will be releasing that on May 22nd, which will be Sunday. And also, me and Jerry have also been hard at work on me and his side project together called Starship Poopers, which is a play on the Starship Troopers franchise, obviously. But he has been hard at work writing the lyrics, and I've been making the musical tracks. So we're not really sure when we're going to release it yet, but sometime in the near future. So be looking forward to that. And because it's the two of us, you can be guaranteed that it's going to be fucked up in some way. So yeah, keep an eye out for that. I'll make an announcement when we're going to be releasing that, when we release it. So for this episode, I thought I'd take on some of the worst horror movies that feature the word versus in it. You know, such as blank blank versus blank blank. Because there are some truly fucking terrible movies in this, I guess you call it a subcategory of horror movies. I decided to do some of the better ones, even though they're really not that great, but that's just my opinion first. But the movies will get progressively worse as I go on with this episode. So we're going to open it up first with 2004's Alien vs. Predator.
Satellites over Antarctica discovered a pyramid.
Where exactly on the ice is this?
It's not on the ice. It's 2,000 feet under it. Let's make history.
Oh my God.
Whoever built this pyramid believed in ritual sacrifice.
Did you hear that?
Sacrificial chamber.
This story's all here. This whole thing was a trap.
They're not hunting us. We're in the middle of a war.
They're using us as bait.
The movie opens in 1903, where a whaling operation is completely wiped out by a lone predator. We then fast forward to 2004, where a predator ship arrives on Earth and uses a heating device to melt a hole in Antarctic ice. Meanwhile, a satellite detects a heat bloom beneath some, I don't even remember how to pronounce the name, an island about 1,000 miles off the coast of Antarctica. Wealthy industrialist Charles Whalen discovers through thermal imaging that there is a pyramid buried 2,000 feet beneath the ice. He assembles a team of experts to investigate, including archaeologists, linguists, mercenaries, and a mountaineering guide named Lex Woods. Terminally ill, Whalen desires to claim the discovery in his own name. When the team arrives at the abandoned whaling station from the beginning of the movie, they find an unnatural tunnel running directly beneath the ice towards a pyramid. The team then descends the tunnel and begins to explore the pyramid, soon finding evidence of an ancient civilization and what appears to be a sacrificial chamber filled with human skeletons that all have ruptured rib cages. Meanwhile, three predators, Scar, Celtic, and Chopper, arrive and kill the remaining team members on the surface. They make their way down to the pyramid and arrive just as the team unwittingly activates the structure and are trapped within it. The xenomorph queen awakes from cryogenic stasis and begins to produce eggs. When the eggs hatch, several facehuggers attach themselves to humans trapped in the sacrificial chamber. Chestburstersthen emerge from the humans and quickly grow into adult xenomorphs. The humans take possession of the predator's blasters, and conflict erupts between the predators, xenomorphs, and humans. Celtic and Chopper are killed by a xenomorph, and Whalen buys Lex and Sebastian De Rosa enough time to escape from Scar, giving his life in the process. The two witness Scar kill a facehugger and a xenomorph before unmasking and marking himself with the acidic blood of the facehugger. After Lex and Sebastian leave, another facehugger then attacks Scar. Through translation of the pyramid's hieroglyphs, Lex and Sebastian learn that the predators have been visiting Earth for thousands of years. They taught the early human civilization how to build pyramids and were worshipped as gods. Every 100 years, they visit Earth to take part in a rite of passage by which several humans sacrifice themselves as hosts for the xenomorphs, creating the ultimate prey for the predators to hunt. As a failsafe, if overwhelmed, the predators would activate a self-destruct device to eliminate the xenomorphs, and they deduce that the predators lured them into the pyramid to use as a sacrifice. Lex and Sebastian then decide that the predators must be allowed to succeed so that the xenomorphs do not escape to the surface. Sebastian is captured by a xenomorph, and Lex returns the blaster to Scar. Teaming up, they are then attacked by a xenomorph, and Lex manages to kill it. Impressed, Scar uses part of the dead xenomorph to fashion weapons for Lex, and the two form an alliance. Lex then finds Sebastian, who has become the host for a xenomorph. She mercy kills him, but the xenomorph queen is freed from her restraints, and along with the other xenomorphs, begin pursuing Lex and Scar. Scar detaches and uses a bomb in his wrist module to destroy the pyramid and the remaining xenomorphs and eggs. Lex and Scar reach the surface, and Scar uses acidic xenomorph blood to mark Lex with the xenomorph hunter symbol. However, the xenomorph reappears still alive and attacks. They finally manage to defeat the queen by pushing it over a cliff, dragging her to the ocean floor. However, Scar is fatally wounded in the process. A predator ship then appears, and they retrieve their fallen comrade. An elder predator presents Lex with one of their spears as a gift, and they leave. Lex then walks over to a snowcat and leaves the area, and as the movie ends, and the predator ship, Scar's body lays in stasis, when a chestburster erupts from his chest, and the movie ends. Obviously, combining two of sci-fi slash horror's two most popular villains, the aliens and Predator, obviously, hence the name of this movie. This probably seemed like a really good idea when it first came out, but unfortunately, it really wasn't. I mean, the story is pretty fucking stupid. It's full of stupid people doing stupid fucking things, and the acting, for the most part, is pretty bad throughout this entire thing, except for Lance Henriksen, who plays Wayland, and I forget her name, but she plays Lex. They're really the only two actors in this entire fucking thing that can act worth a shit. And there's some really stupid fucking moments in this movie, like when a bunch of the team members, when they first arrive in Antarctica, are just standing around, and all of them fail to notice this giant fucking predator spaceship that looks like a fucking space whale in the sky fly right over them. Nobody fucking notices it. It's this giant fucking ship, and it doesn't make any sense how anybody could not fucking see it. I just don't fucking understand. And I mean, it's stupid things like this in the story that really make me hate this fucking movie. This had a budget of 60 to 70 million and brought in 177.4 million at the box office. IMDb gave this a 3.6 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 25%, Letterboxd a 1 out of 5, and I give it a 1.2 out of 5. And it would just get worse with 2007's Aliens vs. Predator Requiem.
Nobody's home.
It was outside the window.
I just had a bad nightmare.
What the hell was that?
Following the events of the first film, a predator ship leaves Earth carrying alien facehuggers and the dead body of Scar, the predator that helped Lex defeat the Xenomorph Queen. A chestburster with traits of both predator and alien erupts from Scar's body, and it quickly matures into an adult Preda alien, I guess is the best way to put it, and and starts calling the predators on board. A predator's weapon punctures a hull, and the ship crashes in the forest outside of Gunnison, Colorado, killing all but one of the predators, who is severely injured and sends a distress signal before being killed by the Preda alien. The Preda alien and several facehuggers then escape, implanting embryos into a nearby father and son who are out hunting in a forest, as well as several homeless people who live in the sewers. And the predator homeworld, a skilled veteran predator wolf receives the signal and takes it upon himself to travel to Earth and to hunt and kill the xenomorphs. He arrives at the crashed predator ship, uses a blue acid-like liquid to dissolve and erase evidence of xenomorph's presence, and triggers an implosion to completely destroy the vessel. Meanwhile, ex-convict Dallas Howard has just returned to Gunnison after serving time in prison. He is then greeted by Sheriff Eddie Morales and reunites with his younger brother, Ricky. Ricky has a romantic interest in his classmate, Jess, but is constantly harassed by her boyfriend, Dale, and his two friends. Kelly O'Brien has also just returned to Gunnison after serving in the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division and reunites with her husband, Tim, and daughter, Molly. Darcy Benson, the wife of the killed father, begins searching for her missing husband and son. Meanwhile, local waitress Carrie Adams discovers she is pregnant, but her police officer husband, Ray, is killed by Wolf after witnessing Wolf dissolving the bodies of Darcy's husband and son while he was searching for them in the forest. Wolf then skins his corpse and hangs him upside down from a tree branch for sport. Wolf then tracks several xenomorphs in the sewer and defeats two of them, but as the battle reaches the surface, four disperse into the town. Wolf pursues some to the power plant where collateral damage from his dual plasma caster weapons causes a citywide power outage. Ricky and Jesse meet at the high school swimming pool but are interrupted by Dale and his cohorts just as the power goes out, and a xenomorph enters the pool area, killing Dale's friends. Another xenomorph invades the O'Brien home, killing Tim while Kelly escapes with Molly. And after the fry cook at the local diner where Carrie works is attacked by xenomorphs, Carrie is also attacked after hearing the cook's screams and is impregnated by the Preda alien with multiple chest bursters. Darcy discovers her body in horror, but Sheriff Morales arrives and brings her with him. Kelly, Molly, Ricky, Jesse, Dale, Dallas, and Chef Morales all then gather at a sporting goods store to collect weapons, while troops from the Colorado Army National Guard arrive but are quickly slaughtered by the xenomorphs. Wolf briefly captures Dallas inside the store to use as bait to lure the xenomorphs, but Dallas later escapes. Several xenomorphs arrive and Wolf handily defeats them, and Dale is killed by a xenomorph during the battle, and one of Wolf's shoulder plasma casters is damaged. He then removes his remaining one and modifies it into a handheld blaster. As the survivors gather and attempt to escape Gunnison, they make radio contact with Colonel Stevens and are told that an air evacuation is being staged at the center of town. Dallas and Kelly are skeptical, however, since going there would cause them to become surrounded by the xenomorphs. So they, along with Ricky, Jesse, Molly, and a few others, go for the helicopter at the hospital to get out of town, while Sheriff Morales and Darcy head to the evacuation zone. However, the hospital has been invaded and overrun by xenomorphs, and the Preda alien, who has impregnated some pregnant women to breed more xenomorphs by filling each with multiple fast-growing embryos. Wolf soon arrives at the hospital, where he dispatches more xenomorphs, and during the battle, the Predator accidentally impales Jesse with one of his shuriken weapons. Distraught, Ricky rushes Wolf with rifle fire, only to be injured by the Preda alien. The Predator is then attacked by a xenomorph, and both tumble down an elevator shaft, and Dallas takes possession of Wolf's plasma blaster. Dallas, Ricky, Kelly, and Molly then reach the roof and fight off several xenomorphs before escaping in the helicopter, while Wolf, having survived the fall, battles a Preda alien on the roof in hand-to-hand combat. Wolf and the Preda alien mortally wound each other just as a military jet arrives. However, rather than a rescue mission, the F-22 Raptor executes a tactical nuclear strike that levels the entire city, instantly killing Sheriff Morales, Darcy, and everyone else gathered at Ground Zero. The shockwave then causes the fleeing helicopter to crash in a clearing, where the survivors are rescued by the military. Wolf's plasma blaster is confiscated, and Colonel Stevens presents it to Ms. Yutani, and the movie ends. While the first movie was pretty bad, this one is even worse. There's a lot of gore and extra violence in this one, more so than there was in the first one. I mean, blood and guts fly, people get decapitated, and blah, blah, blah. But that really doesn't make up for the lack of new ideas in this, because it's really pretty much just a rehash of the first one. It doesn't really offer anything new. The acting is better than it was in the first, but it's still, the movie's still populated by stupid people doing stupid fucking shit. And there's really isn't any likable characters in this except for maybe Jesse, but she ended up getting fucking killed anyway. And that kind of did make me sad because she's pretty hot. And she was the hottest actress in this movie. So when she gets wiped out, it's kind of saddening. This had a budget of $40 million and brought in $130.2 million at the box office. IMDb gave this a 4.6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes at 12%. Letterboxd at 2 out of 5. And I agree with Letterboxd and give it a 2 out of 5 as well. And next up, we have 2003's Freddy vs. Jason. Having been trapped in hell after his last defeat, Freddy Krueger hatches a plan. Since he's unable to invade kids' dreams, as the adults of Spreen would have gone extreme to make their children forget about him. Using his remaining power, Freddy resurrects Jason Voorhees. Appearing as Jason's mother, Pamela Voorhees, Freddy manipulates Jason into killing the teens of Spreenwood in order to create a fear in the townsfolk that Freddy has returned, which would allow him to regain his strength. Meanwhile, Laurie Campbell, who lives with their widowed father, has a sleepover with her friends Kia and Gibb. They are later joined by Trey, Gibb's emotionally abusive boyfriend, and his friend Blake. Jason enters the house and murders Trey and his father, and the police suspect Freddy. After a nightmare, Blake awakens to find... Trey is alone when he is killed. And after a nightmare, Blake wakes up to find his father decapitated by Jason, who then kills Blake himself. The police call it a murder-suicide the following day, hoping to conceal Freddy's return from the rest of the town. Meanwhile, Lori's ex-boyfriend Will Rollins and his friend Mark Davis, forcibly institutionalized at the Weston Hills Psychiatric Hospital, are made to take hypnosil to suppress their dreams because of their previous contact with Freddy. A news report about the killings prompts them to escape and return to Springwood to warn Lori about Freddy, and at night, Lori and the others attend a rave in the cornfield, where Freddy tries to kill Gibb in a nightmare, but Jason kills her first in the real world, along with others at the rave, which angers Freddy. Will, Lori, and Kia escape the rave with school nerd Charlie Linderman and stoner Bill Freeberg. After dropping off the ladder three and a confrontation with Dr. Campbell, who was responsible for having Will and Mark both committed to Weston Hills, over Will's certainty that he saw Lori's father murder her mother, Will and Lori head to Mark's house only to see him get killed by Freddy. Deputy Scott Stubbs, believing Jason is a copycat killer, makes contact with Lori and her friends, who deduce Freddy's plans. Learning about hypnosil, they try to get it from Weston Hills. However, Freddy possesses Freeberg, using him to dispose of the medicine. Jason then arrives and electrocutes Stubbs, and Freddy uses the possessed Freeberg to tranquilize Jason, causing him to fall asleep after slashing Freeberg himself in half. The teens then come up with a plan to pull Freddy from the dream world into reality and force him to fight Jason, bringing the unconscious Jason back home to Camp Crystal Lake, where the real estate is in development. Freddy fights Jason in the dream world, where he discovers that Jason has a subconscious fear of drowning as a result of his drowning back in 1957, which anybody who's seen any of these movies, that's just fucking common sense to them. Freddy uses this to his advantage, and Jason becomes afraid, reverting to his younger self. Laurie then goes to sleep in order to pull Freddy out and save Jason. As Freddy tortures Laurie in the dream world, revealing that he murdered her mother, Jason awakens at the real Camp Crystal Lake and pursues the teens, killing Linderman. Laurie is then awakened and pulls Freddy into the physical world, where he is confronted by Jason. Freddy and Jason then fight throughout the campgrounds, during which Jason kills Kia. Freddy uses the construction site to gain the upper hand and cuts off Jason's fingers, allowing Freddy to take his machete. As Freddy is slicing away at Jason, Laurie distracts him before Jason punches his fingerless hand through Freddy's torso, and Freddy then retaliates by plunging Jason's machete into his side, and Jason rips Freddy's gloved arm off. Laurie and Will set the dock on fire, causing numerous propane tanks to explode, which throw Freddy and Jason into the lake. Laurie and Will then embrace as Freddy makes his way to them on the dock and is about to kill the couple with Jason's machete, but he's impaled by Jason with his own clawed arm, allowing Laurie to decapitate Freddy with the machete. Jason then falls off the dock, and Freddy's head and body sink into the lake, both seemingly dead. After dropping the machete after Jason where he was submerged, Laurie and Will leave. The following morning, Jason emerges from the water holding his machete and Freddy's severed head. Freddy winks, and his laughter is heard in the background, leaving the winner ambiguous as the end credits roll. Fans of both franchises have been waiting a long time for this matchup to come to be, as it was hinted at the end of Jason Goes to Hell, where at the final scene shows Freddy's gloved hand come up from the ground and grabs Jason's mask and pulls it back into the ground. So fans knew that this was coming at some point, and years later it would happen. But it definitely wasn't worth the wait. I mean, it's not a terrible movie. It's just pretty fucking stupid. There's a lot more comedy in this than there should have been, I believe, at least. And the story, well, it's not completely stupid. It's still pretty fucking stupid. And once again, it's populated with people in their 30s portraying stupid teens doing stupid fucking shit and deserving to get killed. Such as when Kia is basically taunting Freddy and isn't paying attention, and Jason basically slams her up against a tree, which kills her. And if she hadn't been doing stupid shit, she would have noticed Jason coming up towards her, like any fucking normal person in the real world would have. Like I said, it's not a terrible movie, but it is pretty fucking stupid. Excuse me. This had a budget of $30 million and brought in $116.6 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 5.7 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 41%, Letterboxd a 3 out of 5, and I give it a 2.5 out of 5. And now hold on to your hats, folks, because these movies are going to get really fucking bad. Starting with 2010's Dahmer vs. Gacy.
Have you been told about the project?
Everyone's been very secretive.
DNA cloning, gene isolation, Richard Ramirez, Charles Manson, Casey, Dahmer, all been cloned.
30 of each of these killers alive? Dahmer and Gacy.
Maybe there's something I could do to return the favor.
Murder's at an all-time high.
Running out of shots right here.
Cloning serial killers?
Absolute evil! Your family died because of your mistake!
There's another serial killer. He looks like Jeffrey Dahmer.
Only one of them had cannibalistic tendencies.
The
murdering spree continues.
Fight the war against evil every day.
I surely must be God.
Lord, have mercy on us.
Those crazy killers continue to work their magic.
They're the best thing that's happened to serial killers in the past 20 years. Slaughter innocents in broad daylight.
Return from the bowels of hell to wreak havoc on the earth.
You buried 30 people in the crawl space of your house. What kind of ignorant lowlife does that?
I killed twice that many.
You just want to eat him, don't you?
Dahmer versus Gacy.
A daring bowling alley slaughter.
Starts ripping the man's limbs apart with his bare hands.
Slice the head off of the cashier.
Right into the side of his neck.
Well, I certainly hope that's not a real head.
Dahmer, Gacy.
Another fire.
More killers?
Jesus!
Now that I'd like to see.
A secret government lab run by Dr. Stravinsky has been trying to create the ultimate killer using the DNA of infamous serial killers Jeffrey Dahmer and John Wayne Gacy. But there's one big problem. They've both escaped. Bloody mayhem stretches across the United States as they both go on the ultimate killing spree. And trying to stop the maniacal madness is Ringo, a hick warrior being trained by God, using only a shotgun and a bottle of whiskey. In his road trip to hell, he must first fight off his own demons, not to mention an army of Japanese ninjas and a super serial killer who are all on his trail, and it all leads up to the ultimate showdown with the survivors fighting for their lives. This movie tries to do a couple things, and it fails at every single fucking one. It tries to be gory, but unless you find splattered Smucker's strawberry jam gory, it fails. It tries to be hip and ironically funny, so stupid that it's funny kind of cult flick, but it fails at this even more miserably than anything else. The acting is fucking terrible, except for one person, Art LaFleur. He's been in hundreds of movies. None of them are popping up in my head at the moment, but he's like really the only professional actor in this entire fucking movie. Everybody else just fucking sucks. It's like they hired people off the street without, you know, giving them any prep time to read their lines or learn them, even for that fucking matter. So in my opinion, do anything other than watch this movie. Do the laundry, wash your hair, scrub the floors repeatedly, hit your temple with a ball-peen hammer, ram your head into the fucking wall. Do anything but but watch this stupid fucking movie. If you do, like I did, you will regret it. IMDb gives a 2.7 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 10%. Letterboxd, 1 out of 5. And I give it a 0 out of 5. And that brings us to 2015's Lake Placid versus Anaconda.
There can be only one predator at the top of the food chain. And no predator will settle for number 2. Lake Placid versus Anaconda. They plan to crossbreed a killer crocodile.
My father spent most of his life perfecting the blood orchid serum.
With a giant anaconda.
But it required creating a hybrid.
First fights, always the worst. But now...
I've never seen anything like that in my life.
The terror has been unleashed.
Just another day at the office. We're gonna find that snake before she lays her eggs.
I need those baby crocodiles alive.
And the hunt is on for their favorite food. Sorority girls.
I'm bored. Make them swim. Get in the water.
They're giving Hell Week a whole new meaning.
I didn't raise no fool.
Betsy Butler.
That is one big ass snake.
Looks like your extraction team just got extracted.
Lake Placid versus Anaconda. Now on DVD and digital HD.
A direct sequel to the equally terrible Lake Placid, The Final Chapter. But after surviving that movie, Jim Bickerman, due to his injuries, is left with an eye patch, hook, and wooden leg. Working in Black Lake, Maine, with another mercenary named Beach, they capture a female giant crocodile. They take it back to their truck, where two scientists crossbreed its blood with a female giant anaconda to perfect a blood orchid serum. However, the crocodile escapes, killing the scientists, and freeing a female and two male anacondas before causing the truck to explode. The explosion destroys part of the electric fence keeping the crocodiles in Black Lake. Beach, Bickerman, and the one remaining scientist survive, and a small group of crocodiles also manages to escape. The crocodiles search for food, and one kills Daphne Mailer and her boyfriend, while another kills the remaining scientist, and multiple baby crocodiles kill a poacher. The crocodiles then eventually make their way to nearby Clear Lake, along with the anacondas. Reba, now the sheriff of Black Lake, calls U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officer Will Tully Toll to help recapture the escaped crocodiles. Meanwhile, a group of college sorority girls from Delta Gamma, led by Tiffany and Amber, and two fraternity boys from Sigma Pi, Brett and Andrew, arrive at Clear Lake to initialize some new members, including Margo and Tully's daughter, Bethany. The crocodiles feast upon sorority girls along with Amber, who Tiffany pushes towards the crocodiles, Brett, Andrew, and Heather, and the survivors run into the forest to get to the cars. However, the girls left the keys on the beach, but after the crocodiles attack the students, one of the girls, Cassie, runs out of Jennifer's car, but a crocodile attacks and eats her. Tiffany's car is crushed by an anaconda, with Jennifer still inside, and a crocodile kills Tiffany and the others run away. Deputy Ferguson discovers one of the surviving sorority girls hiding on a boat. The traumatized girl, Melissa, is taken to a hospital, while Tully and Reba continue to search for Bethany, and Clear Lake is evacuated by Ferguson. Meanwhile, Sarah Murdoch, daughter of the late Peter J.D. Murdoch and CEO of Wexel Hall Corporation in New York, leads a team of herself, Beach, Bickerman, and two mercenaries and go to capture the female anaconda before it lays its eggs. However, one of the mercenaries is attacked by a crocodile and Beach is forced to shoot them both. Tully and Reba are then attacked by a crocodile, which in turn is attacked by an anaconda, which crushes the crocodile until it explodes. The anaconda then escapes and Sarah's group steals a boat, but Bickerman falls off and is dragged underwater by a crocodile. After landing, the other mercenary is killed by an anaconda, and Tully and Reba kill the other anaconda and rescue Bethany, Margo, and Jane. They regroup along with Ferguson until Sarah and Beach arrive. They then discover two crocodiles eating a male anaconda. The female anaconda appears and kills a crocodile, and a crocodile flings a male anaconda into a helicopter, which is containing Sarah's extraction team, causing it to crash. The female anaconda then kills a crocodile and eats Beach alive, who sacrifices his life by detonating a grenade and killing the anaconda that swallowed him. Sarah is then arrested, and Bickerman emerges from the lake, laughing maniacally. As the movie ends, a nest of eggs laid by the female anaconda is shown, and one egg hatches to reveal a baby anaconda with crocodile-like attributes. This is a stupid, fucking stupid movie. That should come as no surprise that it's a fucking sci-fi original movie. And everybody that listens to this podcast knows my disdain for those fucking movies. They all fucking suck. There's not a single one among them that is good. And this just fucking proves it. I mean, even the title doesn't even make any fucking sense. Lake Placid versus Anaconda. How can a fucking lake versus a fucking snake? It doesn't make any sense. And it's not even the same fucking crocodile from Lake Placid. So nothing about this movie's title makes any fucking sense. It never should have been fucking made. I mean, the cast is all right. I mean, it even includes Robert Englund, who is obviously moonlighting it in this, obviously just for a fucking paycheck. But this movie is fucking horrible. Do not fucking watch it. IMDb gave it a 3.2 out of 10. It didn't even chart on Rotten Tomatoes. And for some fucking reason, Letterboxd gave it a 3.4 out of 5. And I give it a 0 out of 5. And that leads us into more retardedness with 2010's Megashark versus Crocosaurus.
It is over. The shark is dead. No one can conclusively say Megalodon was killed.
We're on a hunt, Lieutenant McCormick, to kill a shark.
Things were designed to survive. They survived for more than 400 million years. You know these crocs, they have the intelligence of you.
Who's talking about a crocodile?
All you need to do is focus on a 1,500 foot pissed off crocodile that's heading up the coast.
Yeah, and a hungry megalodon chasing him.
Deep in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, an illegal diamond mining operation awakens a giant 1,500-foot prehistoric crocodile. Meanwhile, on the Atlantic Ocean, the U.S. Navy warship USS Gibson is attacked and sunk by the megalodon that ended up surviving suffocation by the octopus in Megashark versus Giant Octopus, which is the movie that preceded or that came before this. Lieutenant Terry McCormick, who is played by the same dude that played fucking Steve Urkel, Jaleel White, who was experimenting with a sonic shark repelling device, is the sole survivor of the attack. Back in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, an English hunter named Nigel Putnam successfully captures a giant crocodile when it attempts to eat him, but he injects his tranquilizer darts into its mouth. He then has the crocodile delivered to a shipping yard for his friends to load onto a cargo ship. In L.A., McCormick is being interrogated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Special Agent Hutchinson for the USS Gibson incident. He feels responsible for the sinking, suggesting that his sonic device lured in the megalodon. Because of this, he offers to help Hutchinson hunt down the megalodon with his invention. Meanwhile, a cargo ship is carrying a tranquilized crocodile on the Atlantic Ocean 400 miles south of Florida. It is revealed that the ship is also carrying the crocodile's eggs. Then, without warning, the ship is attacked by the megalodon, waking up the crocodile from its sleep. Putnam and his partner Gene jump overboard before the ship is destroyed in the ensuing battle. Aboard the aircraft carrier USS Lexington, McCormick is introduced to Admiral Calvin, who informs him that his elite crew has only one objective, to hunt down and destroy the megalodon. McCormick is given a room aboard the carrier and the most advanced tracking equipment. Hutchinson is then sent to a remote island to meet and interrogate Putnam, who had just washed up ashore following the cargo ship incident. Hutchinson is shocked when Putnam informs her of the crocodile he captured, as her team was only aware of the megalodon. She then has him handcuffed and brought back to the carrier. Once there, the crew discovers the appearance of eggs on another island. Admiral Calvin assigns McCormick to accompany Hutchinson and Putnam and capture the egg. Upon arriving on the island, they discover that the eggs are laid by the shoreline and are about to hatch. When the fin of the Megalodon is seen nearby, Hutchinson orders the Lexington to launch a missile strike on the island. And as the team leaves the island, the Megalodon swallows the eggs, angering the crocodile, while a squadron of F-18 Hornets fire their missiles at a cave holding more eggs. As the crocodile invades Miami and heads towards Orlando, McCormick suggests using an arc flash powered by the nearby Turkey Point nuclear generation station to ward it off. The gamble works as the arc flash sends the crocodile back into the sea. Back aboard the Lexington, Putnam suggests dissecting a crocodile egg to find its vulnerable factors, and the team is informed that one egg is aboard the submarine USNS Invincible, and two are being transported by Black Hawk helicopters. They also discover that the Megalodon is attracted to the eggs, as it has devoured the Invincible and the Black Hawks transporting them. As no cage or trap is big enough to capture both creatures, Putnam suggests throwing both the Megalodon and Crocodile into the Panama Canal, much to McCormick's disapproval. The submarine USS Argonaut is sent to the wreckage of this cargo ship to retrieve some crocodile eggs, and for once the retrieval mission is a success, and the eggs are dropped into the Panama Canal. Instinctively, both the Megalodon and the crocodile arrive at the canal, where they battle each other while being attacked by the Navy. The fight causes a tidal wave that destroys the entire Panama Canal, as both creatures continue to bite one another. And that's as far as I'm going to go with this fucking stupid movie. It's another one that is not worth the fucking watch. It's another sci-fi fucking original. And it's just about as bad as fucking Sharknado. The fucking CGI effects are fucking terrible. It looks like a half-retarded five-year-old probably programmed into the computer. And nobody bothered to, you know, see what it looked like before they fucking put it into this film and released it. The acting is surprisingly okay. It's not the best. Believe me, it's not any Oscar-winning shit. But it's much better than this movie deserves. But that doesn't mean you should watch it, because this is a gigantic piece of shit. IMDb gave this a 2.4 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 10%. Letterboxd a 1 out of 5. And I once again give it a 0 out of 5. And that brings us to the final shitty movie of this episode. And that is 2004's Boa vs. Python.
This is a once in a lifetime, gentlemen. We are the knights that are going to slay the dragon. One of the most cunning predators on this planet.
Lock and load, boys. We're in Python country.
I understand you've grown a rather large snake here on the premises.
She's a constrictor. Scarlet Queen Boa. I'd like to use your boa to locate and eliminate that python.
The world's two most powerful predators.
This thing is on the loose.
You are going to find it?
Exactly. Fish and Game Department's got a file 2 inches thick on this guy. That's his python down there.
Set loose.
Using my implants, we can track the boa as it tracks the python and see every move she makes.
To fight for survival.
We gotta get him out of there.
In about 3 minutes, that tunnel's gonna be filled with several thousand gallons of water.
Come on! Now, the rampage begins.
The movie opens with two masked wrestlers, one named Boa, the other Python, grappling. Enjoying this spectacle is multimillionaire casino owner Broderick and his girlfriend Eve. Their night out is interrupted by a phone call. The caller, Ramon, informs Broderick that his package has arrived overseas from South America and is being delivered. Broderick is delighted and promises lucrative compensation to Ramon for his work. During the journey, whatever is sealed inside the back of the truck has awakened and become enraged. Ramon stops the convoy and gets a tranquilizer gun, ordering a panel to be opened. Unfortunately, a serpentine tail smashes through the panel and begins to wreak havoc. One of the men is startled and fires his gun, accidentally hitting the main control circuit on the back of the truck. The main door of the sealed container opens, and a hugely large, nightmarish, reticulated python, about 80 feet long and 12, or 80 feet long, merges and kills the group. Ramon detonates a bomb in the process, destroying the convoy, but not the snake. Broderick reveals his plan to bring extreme big game hunting to the city as yet another pastime for the mega wealthy, and the python is to be the quarry. Broderick then sees a news report detailing the destruction of Ramon's convoy. Now realizing the python has escaped, Broderick decides to bring his big game hunting associates to their prey. FBI agent Sharp investigates the wrecked convoy and discovers a large snake scale on the wreckage. Quickly realizing that he is up against, Sharp is determined to prevent the snake from killing more people. He enlists herpetologist Dr. Stephen Emmett and marine biologist Monica Bonds to devise a plan to stop the python. They plan to merge Monica's dolphin camera headgear and tracking system to Dr. Emmett's giant 70-foot-long, genetically enhanced scarlet boa named Betty, and they hope Betty will seek out and kill the python. The trio, now joined by a backup team of FBI agents and U.S. Army soldiers, transports Betty to the water treatment facility, and she quickly enters and begins to track the python. The tracking system proves faulty, however, providing only sporadic coverage. Broderick and the surviving hunters enter the opposite end of the treatment facility and begin to track the reptile. They are surprised when they stumble upon a nest of eggs, which is guarded by Betty, whom they had not expected to see. Betty constricts Eve, killing her, which causes Broderick to snap. Eventually, he makes his way out alone, the rest of his team being killed by both of the snakes. Broderick finally meets up with Dr. Emmett and Monica, and the python devours the eggs, which enrages Betty, who engages the python in a fight. Broderick is then taken into custody. The tracking system starts to function again, and Dr. Emmett finally sees Betty's nest. He decides to go back into the treatment facility to save the nest, and Monica goes with him. Broderick, however, has snuck away and commandeered an APC. Dr. Emmett and Monica, using the tracking system, track Betty to a nightclub because, you know, all giant snakes want to go get their fucking groove on. Betty smashes through the floor, as does the giant python. The two snakes grab Broderick and, in a vicious and bloody tug of war, bisect him, and each devours one half. The two snakes then continue to battle underneath the disco, with Dr. Emmett and Monica hot on their trail. The battling snakes end up fighting on subway tracks. Betty is winning, but a train is about to run over both combatants. Betty is saved by Dr. Emmett, who activates an electrical spike device he implanted into her head. The shock throws her off the tracks, just as a speeding bullet train slams into the python and decapitates the snake. Dr. Emmett and Monica celebrate the death of the python, but become concerned when it is revealed Betty has crawled away. The duo then heads back into the treatment facility to bring Betty and her remaining eggs home, and the movie ends. Well, this movie isn't quite as bad as the last couple I've talked about. It is pretty bad, even though the cast and acting abilities of the cast is better than most of the movies I've talked about this episode. I mean, it still sucks. The CGI still sucks for all the snakes. The blood and gore is shittily programmed CGI blood and gore, which means it looks completely fake. And it's just okay for what it is. It's not anything special, and it's not anything mind-blowing, and it's not something you're gonna watch or you're gonna wanna watch over and over again. But like I said, it is a lot better than the last couple movies I've talked about. IMDb gave this a 2.5 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes of 20%, Letterboxd a 2 out of 5, and I give it a 1.5 out of 5. And that just about wraps it up for this episode, guys. As always, you can reach me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see y'all next time.